Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at siftedaswheat.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart. Glenn and Carol found themselves drowning in mediocrity. They came to my office not because they were on the verge of divorcing, but because their lives were drifting apart, as Carol put it. They felt they hardly knew each other anymore. She was angry for sure, but underneath her anger was a deep sense of sadness that seemed to say she'd lost Glenn somewhere along the way, that he seemed totally disconnected. Every time Carol would try to reach out for him, she experienced him as emotionally unavailable, which only served to fuel her anger. Perhaps you can relate. Maybe you don't feel known by your spouse anymore. Or maybe you've never really felt known by anyone. Maybe your family didn't talk about emotions or value things of the heart, so that's made it difficult for you to know yourself, much less others. But what if you had a set of tools drawn from new information about the brain and interpersonal relationships and how they shape our beliefs about self, God, and the world around us that would assist you in being known and connecting with others on a deeper level? Would you take the risk? We're going to talk about all this and more on today's show with psychiatrist Dr. Kurt Thompson. He's the author of Anatomy of the Soul, an exciting book which demonstrates how insights from interpersonal neurobiology resonate with biblical truths about God and creation, validating the deep human need for meaningful relationships as a key to a life of hope and transformation. Dr. Thompson is the founder of Being Known, an organization which develops teaching programs, seminars, and resource materials to help individuals explore the connections between interpersonal neurobiology, Christian spirituality, and relationships which lead to genuine change and transformation. Dr. Thompson, welcome to Heartline.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
You begin your book with a powerful concept of how being known impacts our life's trajectory, both neurobiologically and at the heart level. You share candidly about several things you realized in your mom's hospital room as she lay dying. An important part of that was born out of the telling of story. For the first time, you said you really heard your mother's story, and out of that, made sense of your own. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that one thing that would be important would be to remember is, I mean, as I remembered this, is that I was sitting with her in the wake of having just come from this conference in which I'd been introduced to principles about interpersonal neurobiology and the various ways that memory plays a role in what I'm doing at any given moment, the ways emotion plays a role. And I had been introduced to them in ways that even in the 20 years that I've been practicing psychiatry hadn't really thought about before. And I think the biggest thing that was significant in that moment was that in beginning to pay attention to these new things, things that were new for me. For the first time ever, I really was having the opportunity to imagine her story rather than protecting my own. So often in conversations that I had had with her, so much of all the nonverbal cues that were exchanged between the two of us left me feeling kind of anxious and feeling like I needed to solve a problem. And it really didn't allow me to really very deeply hear the story that she was trying to tell. And so for the first time, I was having the experience, at least as I recall it, I was having the experience of perhaps being able to be empathic with her, really trying to get myself into the shoes of a 3- and 4-year-old person who essentially had been orphaned. And hearing that, feeling that, sensing that, imaging that in ways that I never had before. And I think it doesn't take much to see that most of our world, when we interact with other folks, anytime there's some level of distress that takes place between two people, two groups of people, two countries, that there is inherently a great deal of difficulty for the parties involved to really hear and sense the real story and all of its different elements that's coming from the one who's speaking to them. And often this is because, of course, we're all kind of in some form of distress. We're angry with each other. We're afraid of each other. We are embarrassed in the moment and so forth and so on. And so much of our interaction, and quite literally, our brains tend to do this very automatically. So much of our interaction is really based on defending ourselves. And, of course, this is where the gospel introduces itself. I'm struck that this is Good Friday on which we're having this conversation. The gospel introduces a very, very different ethic, a very, very different way of being with that Emmanuel, God with us, that God comes to be with us in our story without defending himself against all that we seem to throw at it. And so I think the difference in this was that for the first time ever, I was having the privilege of being able to be in her story, hear her story, without having to defend myself against all my own stuff that would typically get activated in other conversations that she and I had.
Hmm. So really hearing her story helped you make sense of yours.
It did, because I think that what we find is that as I heard her story, I was really able to be present with her, and my mind wasn't so committed to simply protecting me and protecting myself. And as such, I was, for the first time, really able to start to literally see the connections between the way she had to protect herself in her own story, the way she was doing the best she could, would naturally lead toward her doing certain things in her parenting of me. And would naturally lead me to start, even in that conversation, I started to ask some of the same questions about how the way I would respond to certain things, responses that I didn't even like, were not necessarily because I was an awful person, but because I was trying to do the best that I could, because it was coming out of my own implicit memory, some of my own ancient neural networks, as it were. And as such, really hearing for the first time, making sense of how my story came to be where it was, and it wasn't really all that crazy.
Yeah.
And that was really quite liberating.
Yeah, you were trying to protect yourself just like your mom had been trying to protect herself.
Exactly.
I was having this exact conversation with somebody yesterday. How do you think that our earliest interactions with interpersonal relationships impact our brain development?
Well, you know, I think that... again, you know, kind of piggybacking right off this idea about being known, one of the things that that we are learning with research both in neuroscience areas as well as the research in the field of attachment is the idea of how significant it is that brains be connected to one another. And this interpersonal connection, these interactions begin... Actually, there are some researchers who would say that these interactions begin while the baby is even in utero. But certainly, as soon as the baby enters the world, as we like to say, infants come into the world looking for someone looking for them.
Hmm.
And what this tends to reflect is, first of all, the deep neurologic correlation for connection. There's a researcher at the University of Virginia, Jim Cohn, who has been demonstrating this idea that and speculating that it may be the case that the single most fundamental human unit from a brain standpoint is not an individual person, but rather a unit of at least two or more persons.
So a significant other, mom, dad.
Right. It could be any significant other with whom we are linked from a neurologic standpoint, from an emotional standpoint. And these linkages, interestingly enough, I think are so powerfully reflected and reflect that what we see in the creation narratives of Scripture. In the first chapter of Genesis, when God goes to the trouble of saying, let us make mankind in our image, already you have reflections of a Trinitarian God. Already you have reflections that the created humankind was basically a dyad. It was a couple. It was a unit of community. It was not individuals. And this, it goes further in verse 27, I mean, in the second half of verse 26 in the first chapter of Genesis. He talks about then, let them rule over the earth. And so it's not just a matter of how we are connected that's so important, but being connected then lets us do what we are intended to do. It enables us to be creative. It enables us to be the best educators, the best therapists, the best engineers, the best of everything that we were intended to do. All fundamentally begins with this idea of connection. And these connections begin very early from the time that the infant is born. And this, of course, leads into questions about attachment. One of the things that we know about the research in this field of attachment, or this idea of how human beings connect with one another, is that the processes of interpersonal relationship literally shape the way the brain wires. We know that people who have secure attachments reflect what we call a well-integrated prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex being the front part of the brain that is responsible for a number of different functions that enable us to get along well in the world. And those functions develop effectively through proper interpersonal interactions between parent and child. And when that doesn't happen, when those interactions are not very helpful, when parents ignore emotional states, when children grow up in families where there's a great deal of anxiety, or where there's alcoholism, or where there's an absence of emotion, when they grow up in those environments, different parts of the prefrontal cortex don't wire very effectively. And as such, we grow up having a great deal of difficulty regulating emotion, being able to modulate our fear, being able to attune in our communication with others, being able to be empathic or to have insight. And so there are a range of different ways in which fundamental human interactions that enable us to be good citizens, ultimately, are deeply dependent upon what happens in those first early years of interactions with our primary caregivers.
Explain to folks, just for clarity, Kurt, how an attachment bond, attachment relationship is different from any ordinary relationship, like a close relationship. Attachment relationships being, you know, with significant people in our world.
Yeah, I mean, it is fair to say when we talk about attachment, we can use that word kind of loosely, and we might think that we're attached to a lot of different people. We might think that we're attached to the people that we work with, you know, in our office. Or that we play basketball with once a week. But really, technically, what we mean by this are those people in our lives with whom we have emotionally intimate connection and contact. Now, it's important to know that we can have deep contact and connection with people that we don't get along with very well. And this has a lot to do with things like when we have relationships with parents, for example, who we may have fractured relationships with, but we have very strong connections with based on the time spent with them and the intimacy of the interactions with which we had with them. Most folks at any given time in their life may have deep attachment with anywhere from two or three to maybe six or eight people. And these attachments go a long way in shaping and reinforcing the nature of how we then tend to get along with everybody else in our sphere of experience. And so we would say that some of the first people that we would have attachments with would be our primary caregivers. It could be parents, it could be grandparents, it could be older siblings. But we can also have very strong attachments with people who meet us at particular times in life. We can have strong attachments with, let's say, an early elementary school teacher, or a youth group leader, or a pastor, or a discipler. There can be a range of different people over the course of our life with whom we have very strong attachments that are all related to this question of how deeply we are emotionally connected to them.
Mm. And going back to what you said earlier, you know, kids come into the world, they're kind of asking several questions. Am I loved? Am I valued? And is my attachment figure sufficiently near, responsive, and attuned to me?
Mm-hmm.
So that attachment figure then needs to be a secure base and safe haven type person.
That's right.
They aren't always, but that's hopefully, you know, what we're getting. And God being social in his orientation, as you said, through creation of angels, creation of man, nature of the Trinity, is our ultimate attachment figure.
Right, right. And I think that this is where, you know, in Anatomy of the Soul, we point out that, you know, the real challenge is that the biblical narrative would appear to tell us a story of a God who is with us, a God whose first posture toward us, his last posture toward us, is one of, you are my daughter, you are my son, whom I love, and in whom I'm well pleased. That is his posture. Our problem is that we have other attachment experiences that tend to echo very different voices. And consequently, we end up reading the biblical narrative, we end up imagining God through the lens of our own attachments with human beings.
Absolutely.
And as such, it becomes very difficult for us to actually live a life in which we feel and sense those things that Jesus felt and sensed in Luke 3:22 when he heard God say, "You are my son, whom I love, and in whom I'm well pleased." And for this reason, the body of Jesus is so crucially important. For this reason, it is so important for us to have embodied, regular experience with people who hear our confession, who hear everything there is to hear, who offer us forgiveness, who instruct us, who are God to us in the flesh. And this is, and what this then does is offer us an opportunity to have real life change by having real brain change by interacting with other people in this body of Jesus that Paul so eloquently talks about in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and 13.
Yeah, so basically what you're saying is that if these attachment bonds are safe and secure, then I have the ability to launch out and explore the world around me. If a child gets the consistent message that the parents are preoccupied, unattuned, unavailable, if the answers to those questions, am I loved, valuable, are consistently no, the child's going to develop some defenses, which translate into things like fear, anger, and anxiety.
Of course.
And so those are the lenses through which we begin to view others. But what you're saying in the book is that that's wiring our brains, and that's the powerful thing behind all this. All
that's
those interactions are actually carving neural pathways into our brains, correct?
That's correct. I mean, when St. Paul talks about transforming the mind, he's not just talking about some abstract idea. Even though he would not have been a neuroscientist, I mean, we're talking about a God who is quite serious about changing who we literally are in our bodies. And that this is a picture of a form of what is coming in the new heaven and the new earth. And so literally we have all this old stuff, this old woman, this old man, this old stuff that is in us that St. Paul talks about in Romans 7 that is being put to death on a regular basis. And that new creation is being born out of this. But it's why, you know, changing is so difficult, because our neural networks are so solidly embedded in terms of all these things that we've been doing.
Yeah, so they become fixed due to these patterns of relatedness that we continue to experience over time. The cry of attachment is, I need to be known. I need to know that you're there for me when I need you. And that's why I love what you write about this whole idea of being known. How does being known satisfy us at the heart level and neurobiologically?
Well, I think this is where we like to talk about the process of integration in our work, and that being this idea that systems in the world, whether you're talking about living systems like a human brain, or you're talking even about non-living systems like a cloud, like geological formations, like weather patterns, systems that tend to function in flexible, energetic, and stable ways tend to be ones in which their various parts, the various parts of the system, all come together and work together efficiently and in a communication state. So the example I give is, if you have a business and the business has several divisions to it, it has a sales division and research and development and marketing and so forth, the mind is like that kind of system in that we have things like attention, memory, emotion, our bodily function, and so forth, that are all part and parcel of the mind's activity.
But I guess the thing I'm wondering is, you know, knowing things, facts, is different than being known at the heart level.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we can know Bible verses about, you know, husbands love your wives as Christ loved the church, but our ability to actually display those virtues and put that knowing into action sometimes eludes us.
Right.
How help us out with that.
Well, here's where I think it's important for us to be aware of a larger picture, and that is, you know, we live in a world since the dawn of consciousness, with in Genesis 3 the awareness of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, in which knowing things is equated with power. And not that knowing things in and of itself is all bad, but we tend to know things because when I know things, I then can have the sense that I can be in charge and in control and am invulnerable to things. And so we tend, and then we live now in the last 400 years of the Enlightenment, where not only as part of human nature, but as a active social construct, this idea of a cultural norm that knowing things is going to bring us to progressive perfection eventually. We're often not even aware that this is the kind of water as fish in which we are swimming all the time. We live it, we breathe it, and we often don't even know that. The biblical narrative is a radically different narrative compared to the narrative of our culture that says it's really important to know things, which is largely a function of the left mode, the left hemisphere of the brain. To be known actually draws to the table other parts of the brain, especially the right hemisphere, especially lower brain parts, especially parts of our brain that regulate body function. And in order for us to be aware of and open to these things, and actually even sharing these things with other people, requires a certain degree of vulnerability. For me to tell someone, not just that I know something, but that I actually feel something, I feel hurt, I feel worried, opens me to a place of vulnerability. And we live in a culture in which we've learned very, very powerfully not to let ourselves be vulnerable because the world's not a safe place.
Mm-hmm.
The gospel, first and foremost, declares that through the resurrection of Jesus, Jesus is in charge. And the world is ultimately a safe place in which I can be free and open. Now, we can choose not to believe that, but that is, in fact, what the gospel declares. And as such, when we are interacting with people who are inviting us to put our heart on the table, It is an invitation into the world that we believe really exists, and that is the world that Jesus is in charge of. So that, therefore, when we talk about the importance of being known, we're talking about not just opening ourselves to others, but we are also talking about making a push against an entire culture that wants to say that, no, knowing things is the most important thing to do. But it is in the course of being known that more of our mind is integrated. And we do so mostly through the interactions of allowing our mind to be connected with other people.
And so part of how we do that then is through the telling of our stories.
That's exactly right. And as we tell our stories, and this is where, you know, research in attachment theory also has been very, very helpful, because an instrument called the adult attachment interview is a process that evaluates not just the facts that a person tells, not just the items that they tell about, but the way they actually tell their story. And so when we tell a story, what's important, as you would note from any good storyteller, it's not just what are the details that are included, but what are the nuances of emotion? What are the things that we do remember and don't remember? What are the things that we include and don't include? And in the course of telling our story to someone who is empathically listening, that process gives us that experience of feeling felt, as my friend Dan Siegel likes to say, this experience of feeling felt, of being known, the experience of having my story understood, perhaps for some, for the very first time. And what's significant about that is that as my story is understood by another, I am able to understand my story for the first time. As we like to say, I can only understand my story effectively through the eyes and ears of another person. I cannot understand my story by myself.
That's powerful. Kurt, we're out of time for today. Thanks for your willingness to join us next week to continue our discussion on anatomy of the soul.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
I had a big hole in my heart, and I was looking. I was looking everywhere.
Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at siftedaswheat.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.